to the three readings today are really rich, and so I'd like to comment briefly on each of them. Over and over, we get this thing about the law in the Hebrew Bible. And I think about 99% of the time, we misunderstand what's being referred to here. The law is not, as in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, a kind of self-subsistent, abstract set of prescriptions for how you're to comport yourself. The law for the Jews was always a measure of relationships. The only reason that the law came into the thing is that they used this metaphor of the covenant, you know, the new covenant. Okay, what was a covenant? A covenant was a standard political arrangement in the ancient world between a vassal and the lord. And so they made an arrangement. I will protect you, and you will take care of my fields and sheep and all that other stuff. In other words, it's a question of a response to a person, not to some abstract formula written in stone someplace. That's what the law is supposed to be, and we, of course, have denatured it to a very large extent, I think, at least in my experience, when I was constantly hammered by the nuns with what the law says, you know. It should have been patent that that was a misunderstanding of things, because the law is summarized as it is here in love. You can't legislate love, as we all know very well. You cannot legislate. Thou shalt love. Try it. All of you who have kids, it don't work, folks. So, we need to recast our understanding of the law. This is supposed to be a way of responding to people. I respond to God, who is the source of my life and being and all that I am and have. And in the light of that understanding, the God, the creator of all of us, then I respond to each other of us human beings. Because everybody has received everything they have from God. Everybody is valuable because they bear within themselves the image of God, as the Bible will say over and over again. Legalism has been one of the besetting crimes, and crime is not too strong a word, of the Christian churches. They're all built that way. Lutherans, Calvinists, Baptists, I suppose even the Pentecostals. Where you just have this set of directions, like you come out of your womb with a little scroll in your hand with the Ten Commandments on it. Oh, this is what I gotta do. No. The observance of the law must be an act of freedom, an act of response to God and to other people. And this could be hammered on for days and days and days. Although the tradition that we live in, the tradition of Anglo-Saxon law, we're a nation of laws, not people. The U.S. boasts entirely. Well, that's rubbish. That's totally opposed to the Jewish understanding of law. Law is how we deal with each other in the face of our common creation by God. Okay, now to skip to the gospel. It's very interesting, especially in the gospel of Matthew, who does this in spades. This was Luke, of course. But every time Jesus gets mad, and it only happened once, so far as I know, that as put in the New Testament, the cleansing of the temple. What was that about? Is some kind of protest of mercantilism in this holy place? No. Jesus got mad for the same reason Jesus was happy. If you read the Gospel of Matthew in particular, the only people that Jesus really got mad at, the only people, were religious people, religious professionals, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. The Sadducees were the priestly caste, and the Pharisees were the religious lawyers. Brood of vipers, whitened sepulchres, who taught you to flee from the wrath of God? And what we have in this case, of course, is precisely this, the law superseding our real relationships with each other. And that's what got Jesus mad. The priests had turned the temple into a big money-making machine. So they could collect all kinds of stuff and then go up north where there's good agricultural land and then buy it up and then pauperize the people who were there. Jesus was concerned about these priests, these religious people, defrauding people. Who was a servite? Who was a priest? They're both attached to the temple. And not too far removed from the clericalism of our own day, they saw themselves as superior beings. Doesn't work. It's not true. Again, another besetting sin. Because if you look at the lives of the saints, they didn't ask, are you a Pharisee? Are you Catholic? Are you Lutheran? Are you Calvinist? No, we happily killed each other on those grounds. Yeah. So it is supposed to be love which liberates. Love which makes us free for the other. As I've been saying over and over these past few weeks. And Jesus does the regular rabbinic thing. He doesn't lay down a law, you will notice in this passage, which is absolutely archetypal. Jesus tells a little story. So these three guys run across this battered up guy lying on the highway. The priest will not touch him because he thinks he might be dead, and you're going to be ritually impure if you touch a corpse. Same thing for the servite. The same thing. In other words, the law of purity, of ritual purity, superseded their humanity so that they could really respond to the fellow human being, to these people, to this one guy who's so badly beat up, and who, to even draw the point more sharply, who is the hero of the story? And Jesus doesn't lay down the law. He asks the guy, who do you think is the hero of the story? And the guy said, the Samaritan. Who are the Samaritans? The Samaritans occupied the middle range of property in Israel. They were considered half-breeds. They're considered heretics by the people up north in Galilee, and even more so by the people in Jerusalem, the priests and all the religious types. I've been haunted all week by this. It's only the religious type, the professionally religious type, that really get Jesus' goat, that move him to complain bitterly. There is no other instance in the New Testament where Jesus is complaining about people, except for these religious officials. That's really important. Because I dare say I know deep in my own consciousness, and I've been haunted by this again all week, when I'm called to see the bishop, which mercifully does not happen very often, I enter his office with the mindset, the boss is going to tell me what to do, and I will do it. Period. Full stop. There is no conversation. There's no dialogue. And again, we have this person personifying the magisterium, the power of the church, you know, the hierarchy. And you're just supposed to, when they say jump, you ask how high. That's rubbish. Behold, I am among you as one who serves. Jesus is quoted as saying in the New Testament. Okay, and finally to this passage in Colossians. Colossians is not written by Paul on a whole bunch of grounds. That's clear and agreed upon by all scholars. Paul did not write the letter to the Colossians. Why? Paul looked at Jesus in a drastically different way than the guy who wrote this text did, assuming it was a man. So, Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creatures. That sounds peculiarly Greek to me. The Logos, the whole doctrine of the Logos, the word in Greek philosophy, the world order, the way things are supposed to be, you know. So your job is to get in touch with the Logos and follow its pattern, whatever it is. Paul, on the other hand, always referred to Jesus as the new Adam. Consistently. And the new Adam is not this kind of metaphysical being that Colossians talk about. The new Adam was a person in relationship with God and in relationship with everybody else. But here we have this highly abstract notion of Jesus as the firstborn of all creation. All things in heaven and earth were created, things visible and invisible, blah, 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 blah. Christ is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That's pure Greek philosophy, folks. Okay, the Christians took it over. In fact, if you remember, Pope Ratzinger said that the fact that we went from a Semitic culture, Jewish culture, into a Greek culture, which was drastically different, was an act of providence by God. God wanted us all to be little Greek speakers, you know, running around talking about the Logos. Not likely. Not likely. What if Paul had gone to China or India or South America to preach himself and Christ crucified? As he said last week in the reading. So, I mean, this is useful. It sounds peculiarly like Teilhard's vision, Teilhard de Chardin's vision of the cosmic Christ. You know, it's a wonderful, elevating vision where everything is somehow unified. God was in Christ reconciling all things to himself, namely breaking down all the divisions between us human beings and us human beings and nature. So, this is a useful way of approaching that stuff. But it's not Pauline, and I'm not so sure I am sure it is not as good as the Pauline image of Jesus as the new Adam. Well, he will spell this out, we are a new creation, etc., 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 etc. So, can you do something in your own personal life? Yeah, I think it's possible. Because how many of us walk around with a little voice in the back of our head saying, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. As if that's the beginning, the middle, and the end of religion. The thou shalt and the thou shalt not. No, 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 no. The beginning, the middle, and the end is love your neighbor as yourself. Love your enemies, for God's sake. It's relationships, folks. And it's very hard, at least for me, to relate to this abstract idea of the cosmic Christ who reconciles everything into himself. So, for what it's worth, I hope this is a matter for your own consideration, contemplation, try to figure out where we all are.